Now let's talk about cancer. We're going to talk about the fundamentals of neoplasia. We're starting to get into the juicy stuff now. Let's talk about the epidemiology of cancer, some of the general facts. First of all, you should remember that 90% of cancer arises from epithelium. Only 10% arise from the mesenchymal cells. Another important point is that cancer is the second leading cause of death in the United States. There's an estimated new cancers of about 1.2 million. That's for the year 2000. Take a look at table number 9-1, the 15 leading causes of death in the United States in 1997. And you should at least commit to memory the top five causes of death in the U.S. Number one is heart disease, represents about 31%. Number two is cancer, it's about 23%. Number three is stroke, cerebrovascular disease, followed by COPD and accidents. The next table is table 9-2 that shows the leading causes of death in children ages 1 to 4 in the U.S. The new number one is accidents. It's about almost 40% of deaths. Number two is still cancer. Number three, congenital anomalies. Number four is homicide, and number five is heart disease. Let's go on to the next table. It's table number 9-3. You should know for cancer, the incidence, which cancers are most common. For the year 2000, in males, the number one cancer is going to be prostate cancer. It's about 30%. Number one in females is breast cancer. What's number two? Lung cancer in both males and females. Number three is colorectal cancer. That's the top three. Let's go on to the next table. It's table 9-4. This is the estimated new cancer mortality. In other words, cancer deaths. The most common cause of death from cancer is lung cancer. It kills males and females most commonly. Next is, in males, prostate cancer, in females, breast cancer. And finally, the number three position is colon and rectal cancer. So you should know the top three in terms of incidence and in terms of death. Okay, let's go on and talk about the predisposition to cancer. For each cancer that we get to, as we go through the syllabus, I want you to pay attention to the certain geographic factors. What racial factors? What's the age distribution of cancers? Are there any occupational exposures? All those are very important and highly testable. So let me give you some examples. For instance, if they gave you a patient who came from Japan, you want to be betting on what cancers? Stomach cancer, incredibly high in Japan. What else is common in Japan? Well, they've got a lot of hepatitis virus. So, hepatocellular cancer is also very common. If they're from China, think of nasopharyngeal cancers. Where else? If they are African American and they're male, think of prostate cancer. African Americans have much higher rate of prostate cancer than Caucasians do. So you got to use these as clues. Try and play the odds with cancer. Okay, let's talk about hereditary predisposition. Board loves to talk about what syndromes increase your risk. One is called familial retinoblastoma. Obviously, they have a defect in the retinoblastoma gene, and they have an increased risk of retinoblastoma. Next group of diseases is called the multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome. This is an autosomal dominant group of diseases that has in common tumors of endocrine organs. The next one is familial polyposis coli. Again, this is an inherited disorder, and you develop multiple adenomatous colonic polyps and eventually colon cancer. Let's talk about some acquired premioplastic conditions. A big one in the United States is cervical dysplasia, caused by HPV virus, human papilloma virus. Starting to go on the downtrend because we're screening and picking up dysplasia earlier and earlier. Next is endometrial hyperplasia. This is a big risk factor for developing endometrial cancer. What else? Another board favorite is ulcerative colitis. Remember, ulcerative colitis increases your risk of developing colon cancer. Now let's talk about carcinogenesis. Let's talk about some of the carcinogenic agents. We'll start with chemical carcinogens. And I want you to remember that carcinogenesis is a multi-step process which has a sequence. The first thing that's going to happen is you're going to have exposure to a chemical which initiates. In other words, it causes a mutation in the DNA. That must occur first. The next change is going to be a promotion. You're exposed to a chemical which promotes the cell. In other words, increases the proliferation of cells. It promotes growth. So first you get the mutation, then you get a chemical which promotes growth of those mutated cells. That's what leads to neoplasia. Okay, there's some clinically important chemical carcinogens under number D, and I want you to pay close attention to the nitrous amines. Those are very important for gastric cancer. I want you to pay attention to asbestosis. It's important for bronchogenic cancer and mesotheliomas. Next page. Arsenic. Board likes to ask about this. Pretty uncommon, but exposure to arsenic can develop squamous cell cancers of the lung and the skin, as well as angiosarcoma of the liver. Next one is vinyl chloride. That can also give angiosarcoma of the liver. Another one they like to test on is benzene, commonly found in smoke. Exposure to benzene increases your risk of developing leukemia, especially AML. And the last one is naphthalamine, especially beta-naphthalamine. This is usually found with dye makers, and it leads to bladder cancer. Okay, let's move on to radiation. I want you to remember that there are two major forms of radiation that can lead to cancer. One is ultraviolet radiation, from the sun especially. The other is ionizing radiation, due to exposure from medical x-rays, atomic bombs, nuclear reactors, and so forth. Okay, let's talk about ultraviolet radiation. It usually comes from the sun, and UVB is the most carcinogenic. What does UVB light do? Well, it produces pyrimidine dimers in DNA, which lead to errors in transcription and translation. The problem with this is these patients tend to develop increased risk of skin cancer, basal cell, squamous cell, melanoma. And in your handout, there's one disease I want you to remember, xeroderma pigmentosum. It's an autosomal recessive disorder, which is a defect in DNA repair. These patients, you got to keep them out of the sun no matter what you do, because they will develop thousands and thousands of skin cancers. It's a terrible disorder, especially if you're living in a very sunny environment. Let's talk about ionizing radiation. By definition, any cell that's proliferating is going to be at highest risk. So cells that are in mitosis or G2 of the cell cycle are going to be most sensitive. And specifically, if they give you a patient who survived the atomic bomb explosion, I want you to think of tumors such as thyroid cancer and also acute myelogenous leukemia. Those are very, very common in survivors of atomic bomb explosions. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about viruses and their oncogenesis. For viruses, there's one RNA, there's four DNA that you need to know about. The RNA virus is called HTLV-1. It causes adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma. For the DNA viruses, these are pretty straightforward. You should remember hepatitis B virus leads to hepatocellular carcinoma. You should remember Epstein-Barr virus, which leads to a bunch of cancers, especially Burkitt's lymphoma. What else? Nasopharyngeal carcinoma. And finally, B-cell lymphomas, especially in immunocompromised patients. Next one is human papillomavirus. This is important for warts, and it's also important for cervical cancer. Last one is human herpes virus number 8. That causes Kaposi's sarcoma. Okay, let's talk about carcinogenesis. In general, remember, carcinogenesis is a multi-step process. It's not just one mutation. It's an accumulation of mutations over time that leads to cancer. The most important mutations that are going to accumulate that lead to cancer usually involve one of the following. They involve proto-oncogenes. Those are growth-promoting genes. Or they can involve growth-inhibiting tumor suppressor genes. Or finally, they can involve the genes regulating apoptosis. Okay, let's start with the oncogenes. For the oncogenes, these are normal genes that promote cellular growth. So if you're a tumor, you want to activate or overexpress these genes so you can proliferate like crazy. And that's what tumors do. Where do oncogenes come from? Well, oncogenes are derived from mutation of proto-oncogenes. Proto-oncogenes is the normal gene that you and I have. When it becomes mutated, we call it an oncogene. Let's look at some of the mechanisms of oncogene activation. Point mutations, chromosomal translocations can activate oncogenes. Gene amplification and insertional mutagenesis all can cause activation of oncogenes. Okay, let's move on to table 9.5 and talk about the most important clinical oncogenes. Okay, first one I want you to pay attention to is the ERB family. ERB1 is important for squamous cell carcinoma, especially of the lung. And this oncogene is important because it is a growth factor receptor, and therefore it's going to promote growth, okay, when you overexpress it. Next one is called ERB2. This one's very important for breast cancer. It's also important for ovarian cancer and lung cancer as well. Again, it's an epidermal growth factor receptor, and it tends to be amplified. ERB3 is also important in breast cancer, and it's also overexpressed. Next family that's important is the RET family. This is found in MEN2 and MEN3. MEN stands for multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome. It's also found in medullary carcinomas of the thyroid. And it's also a growth factor receptor. It's a glial neurotrophic factor receptor. And it's mutated and activated by a point mutation. Okay, next one is a board favorite. It's the ABL oncogene. It's activated by a classic translocation. It's 922. And you'll form the BCR-ABL fusion protein. This protein has tyrosine kinase activity. And it can stimulate growth proliferation by phosphorylating different cellular proteins. Okay, next one they've tested on is KIRAS. That's K-I-R-A-S. This is important in many cancers, especially lung, pancreas, and colon. It's a GTP binding protein, and it's activated by a point mutation. Next family is the MYC family. C-MYC is important for Burkitt's lymphoma. It's usually activated by a translocation. The translocation is 8 to 14. What's on 8? That's where c-MYC is located. What's on 14? That's the heavy chain gene of immunoglobulin. It's constantly expressed in lymphoid tumors. So you take this oncogene, you push it next to a gene that's expressed all the time, and you develop overexpression. And that's the mechanism. The next in the MYC family is L-MYC. L stands for lung. Okay, it's common in small cell lung cancers. Next is N-MYC. N stands for neuroblastoma. Again, it's a nuclear regulatory protein, and it's amplified in tumors. The last two are the cyclins. Cyclin D is important for mantle cell lymphoma, and it's activated by a translocation, 11 to 14. Last one is CDK4. It's important for melanoma and also for GBM, glioblastoma multiforme. Okay, let's talk about tumor suppressor genes. For oncogenes, we wanted to amplify them. For tumor suppressor genes, we want to knock them out. And you got to knock out both alleles. Okay, you got to knock out both alleles to develop cancer. Okay, let's look at some of the important factors. Okay, let's look at some of the mechanisms of action, actually. Let's start with P53. P53 is very important. It's the most common, most commonly deleted or knocked out tumor suppressor gene in human cancer. And what does it do? Well, it's going to arrest the cell and prevent it from entering the cell cycle. It's also going to be important for apoptosis. It's going to promote apoptosis. The RB gene is also important. It's also going to prevent the cell from entering the S phase until you've corrected the DNA damage. So P53, RB, the two most important. Next in your handout is called Knudsen's two-hit hypothesis. All that means is both genes have to be knocked out in order to have oncogenesis. Let's see, how can the genes be knocked out? There's two ways. The first way is there's called a two-hit hypothesis. Two hits meaning the first hit occurs in the germline. The first gene allele is knocked out in the germline. The second knocked out gene is acquired during life. Okay, so those are inherited disorders. Some great examples of that is retinoblastoma. Those kids are already born with one of the retinoblastoma genes knocked out. They're just waiting for that second mutation to develop cancer. Another great example is the Lee Fraumini syndrome. These patients are born with a germline mutation in P53. They're already missing one of the two alleles. So all they need is one more mutation, and then they develop a multitude of cancers. Okay, let's move on to table 9.6 and talk about the clinically important tumor suppressor genes. We've already talked about VHL. That's the important for von Hippel-Lindau disease. It's on chromosome 3P. It's also important for renal cell cancers. Next are the WT1 and 2 genes. WT stands for Wilms tumor, and they're found on chromosome 11. We talked about retinoblastoma, the RB gene. That's found on chromosome 13. And P53, it's common in many different tumors, lung, breast, colon, sarcomas, you name it, P53 has probably been mutated. Okay, the next two are the BRCA, 1 and 2. BR stands for breast, CA stands for cancer. These are common in hereditary breast cancer. The next two are important in colon cancer. It's APC and DCC. APC stands for adenomatous polyposis coli. Okay, and the last two are found in neurofibromatosis. NF1 is found in neurofibromatosis type 1. You'll see it mutated in the neurofibromas. And NF2 is found in the acoustic neuromas and also in meningiomas. Okay, let's talk about the last group of genes that are important for developing cancer. Those are the genes involving apoptosis. I want you to remember back to BCL2. Remember, that's the fountain of youth gene. It's a gene that's going to prevent the cell from undergoing apoptosis. So if you're a cancer cell, you want to live forever. You want to overexpress this gene. And one of the most common tumors that involves mutation of BCL2 are the follicular lymphomas. They tend to have a translocation. It's 14-18. What's on 18, on chromosome 18, is BCL2. You take that, you put it on 14 next to the heavy chain immunoglobulin gene, and you overexpress BCL2. Those cells become immortal. They become cancer. Okay, some other genes that are important. For genes that promote apoptosis, remember P53, that's going to cause a mutated cell to undergo apoptosis and die off. So if I'm a tumor cell, I want to knock out P53. Last one is the c-myc. Remember, that's important for Burkitt's lymphoma. It has a role in apoptosis as well. Okay, now let's switch gears and talk about the diagnosis of cancer. Say a patient comes into your office and they've got this huge fungating mass on their face. It looks ugly. It's hemorrhagic. It's necrotic. You can take a look at it. You can say, yeah, it looks like cancer, but you can never make the diagnosis of cancer until you get tissue. Tissue is the issue when you think cancer may be the answer. Okay? So you've got to get tissue. Okay, let's talk about some of the general features of benign versus malignant neoplasms. For benign neoplasms, they tend to be small in size. They tend to grow slowly. They tend to be encapsulated. Under the microscope, they tend to look like normal. They look like the tissue from which they're arising. They tend to push aside the normal tissue, just push it out of the way rather than invading it. And they tend to be non-invasive, and they never, ever metastasize. Let's contrast that with malignant neoplasms. They tend to be larger in size. They tend to grow very rapidly. They tend to have very poorly defined borders. They tend to be necrotic and hemorrhagic because it's proliferating so quickly. Under the microscope, they vary from being well differentiated to being very poorly differentiated or anaplastic. The tumor cells tend to vary in size and shape. There tends to be an increase in the nuclear cytoplasmic ratio. There tends to be a lot of mitotic figures. And the final thing is they tend to have an invasive growth pattern, and they have the ability to metastasize. That's the most important factor. Okay, let's talk about the histologic diagnosis. You gotta have tissue to make the diagnosis. How do you get tissue? Well, you can excise the lesion. You can biopsy the lesion. You can stick a needle in and do a fine needle aspiration. Or you can do a scrape, a cytologic smear, like a pap smear. You gotta get tissue, otherwise you cannot make the diagnosis. Okay, now, once you've got a biopsy, when a pathologist takes a look at the slide, he'll say, yeah, it's cancer. The next question that a clinician will have is, well, what type? Where is it coming from? And I tell you, as a lot of times as a pathologist, I can look at it, I can tell you it's a tumor, it looks ugly, but it doesn't give me any clues to where it came from. So one of the things I can use as a pathologist is I can take some special stains, some antibody stains, and apply it to the slide, and it will light up certain intracellular characteristics. Okay? So for instance, if you take a look at the immunohistochemistry, there's a list of markers. One of them is thyroglobulin. I can apply a thyroglobulin antibody to the slide. If it sticks to the tumor cells, it must be a thyroid tumor. I can also use S100. Those are great for neural tumors and melanoma. I can use actin, antibodies against actin. Those are great for identifying smooth muscle or skeletal muscle tumors. Next, I can use antibodies against estrogen receptors in breast cancer. That's important for prognosis and treatment. And finally, I can use the whole group of CD markers for leukemias and lymphomas and intermediate filaments. And in your handout, there's a table, it's table number 9-7, expression of intermediate filaments by normal and malignant cells. Now, this is really helpful, because if I get a tumor and I don't even know where it's coming from, I apply these markers. If it highlights for keratin, keratin is expressed by epithelial cells. It tells me that the tumor arose from an epithelium, it must be a carcinoma. Okay, so any tumor that has in its name carcinoma will stain with keratin. Okay, so hepatocellular carcinoma, keratin positive. Renal cell carcinoma, positive. Adenocarcinoma, positive. The next marker I can use is vimentin. Vimentin stains mesenchymal cells. What are mesenchymal cells? Those are all the other cells that are not epithelial. Blood vessel cells, fibroblasts, lymphocyte, bone, you name it, if it's not epithelium, it's mesenchymal, and those will all stain with vimentin. So tumors of those cells, like a chondrosarcoma, a fibrosarcoma, a liposarcoma, all those will be vimentin positive. Okay, let's talk about muscle markers. We've got a muscle marker called desmin. Desmin stains tumors of muscle origin. So a leiomyoma or a rhabdomyosarcoma will both be positive. Okay, we've left out the neural system. The neural system gets two markers. The first one is called neurofilament. It stains CNS and PNS neurons. It also stains neural crest derivatives. So what are some of the neural crest derivatives? Well, a great example is, what part of the adrenal gland? The medulla. So tumors of the medulla will be neurofilament positive. Two big tumors that occur in the adrenal medulla are pheochromocytoma and neuroblastoma. Both will be neurofilament positive. The last marker is called glial fibrillary acidic protein. It stains glial cells like astrocytomas, ependymomas, and so forth. Okay, let's move on to the serum tumor markers. I would commit these to memory. The board loves serum tumor markers with a passion. Before we go through the individual markers, I want to tell you that the serum tumor markers are normal components of normal cells. They are overexpressed in malignant cells. Why is that important? It's important because you can have elevations of tumor markers in tumors, but you can also have tumor markers elevated in non-neoplastic conditions. So for each tumor marker, you should know what tumor is it associated with and what non-neoplastic conditions is it associated with. Okay, let's move on to C and talk about the clinically useful markers. A big one is alpha-fetoprotein. Very, very important for hepatocellular carcinoma and non-seminomatous testicular germ cell tumors. Which one in specific? Yolk sac. Yolk sac is very big for AFP. Okay, what non-neoplastic conditions can be elevated? Well, if you have a neural tube defect, you can have elevations of AFP. Intrauterine fetal demise can increase your AFP. Again, those are non-neoplastic conditions. Next one is called beta-HCG. This is very common in trophoblastic tumors, especially choriocarcinomas, hydatidiform moles it'll be elevated in. What's the non-neoplastic disease? Pregnancy. Pregnancy will also give you a large abdomen and an elevated beta-HCG. Always think of pregnancy before you think of trophoblastic tumors and chorio. Okay, next is lowering yield calcitonin. Calcitonin is produced by medullary carcinomas of the thyroid. Next one is CEA. This is found in a wide spectrum of tumors. Lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, stomach, breast, colon. In clinical practice, we most commonly use it with colon cancer. And we usually use it to monitor treatment. Okay, somebody gets a colon cancer, when you resect that colon cancer, the CEA level should go to zero. If it doesn't go to zero, there's more tumor in the body. If it goes to zero, but a couple of years later you measure it and now it's starting to go up, you have to think about recurrence. Okay, and that's how we usually use CEA. Okay, next is CA125. This is important for epithelial ovarian cancers. Next one is CA19.9. That's 19.9. This is common in pancreatic cancers. Next one is called placental alkaline phosphatase. This one is found in seminomas. And the last two are both found in prostate cancers. PSA, it's all the rage nowadays. It's going to be elevated in prostate cancer. The other one is prostate-specific acid phosphatase. This is a great marker for metastasis. When prostate cancer metastasizes, this usually elevates. Okay, a couple of words about grading a tumor versus staging a tumor. For the tumor grade, the only doctor that can give a tumor a grade is a pathologist. Why? Because the grade is determined under the microscope. And let's look at the criteria. It's based on the degree of differentiation and the number of mitosis. Why do we give a tumor a grade? We want to give an estimate of how malignant the tumor is going to be. Okay. Next is the tumor stage. This is a clinical estimate of the extent of the tumor or the malignancy of the tumor. We usually use what's called the TNM staging criteria. T stands for what is the size of the primary tumor. N stands for what is the status of the regional lymph nodes. Has it spread there? And finally, M stands for the presence or absence of metastatic disease. In general, I want you to remember that staging has a much more important prognostic effect than grading does. Staging is much more important. Okay, let's go on to metastasis. And we're going to talk about the initial roots of how tumors spread. It's actually pretty easy, because most tumors spread by the path of least resistance. They spread through lymphatics. Lymphatics are very small. It's easy for the tumor to invade them, and that's how most tumors spread. Okay, so if you think about that, all you have to memorize are the exceptions. The exception to that rule is tumors that spread by hematogenous means, meaning they go into the veins and into the arteries. Here's the group of tumors I want you to memorize. Most sarcomas spread through hematogenous means. That's one. Number two, renal cell cancer loves to invade the renal vein. It can go up the inferior vena cava and actually make its way all the way to the heart. Another tumor in this category would be hepatocellular carcinoma. It loves to invade the hepatic vein. Next one is a tumor of the thyroid. It's follicular carcinoma. Tends to invade the veins. And finally, the most malignant germ cell tumor of all, choriocarcinoma, it spreads everywhere because it spreads by hematogenous means. The last exception you have to remember is seeding of body cavities. This is exceptionally important for ovarian tumors. Remember, the ovary is hanging out in the peritoneal cavity, and the tumor can actually break off and spread throughout the peritoneum. We call that seeding. That brings us to the conclusion of neoplasia.